You're listening to Live Free, Think Free on 90.1 KPFT Houston, your home for uncensored news and underground music since 2011.
Since 2011, that's a dozen years. Live Free, Think Free, coming at you again. This is Micah. I'm here with my friend Derek. How are you, Derek?
I'm doing good, man. Am I coming through okay?
Yep, sounds good. Sounds good.
All right, I'm happy to be here for another week.
Yep, we're here for another week. I guess this is a news analysis, reflections, music playing show. If you haven't joined us before, all the articles that we reference and talk about here will be available on the HoustonFreethinkers.com, so you can check that out. We invite you to. Seeing some of our occasional listeners joining in different chats. We're broadcasting across a plethora of social media outlets. I'm sure Derek can name the rest. Welcome, welcome. Hope you all enjoy the show and have things before we get into.
Yeah, we're live right now on Facebook, YouTube, on Odyssey, and on Rockfin. Shout out to the Erie Fairy, our first comment of the day. She says hello to both of us. She gets to listen while she eats and then drives. So enjoy your food and enjoy your drive. Hopefully we give you some informative info tonight. We're also going to play a couple of songs, including a brand new one, a never-before-heard anywhere in the world publicly before song, just for Live Free, Think Free, from our friends Total Chaos, old-school punk band, for those who know. I'm going to be debuting a song from them tonight called Welcome to the New World Order later on in the show, so stay tuned. And today's title, I just went with, Micah, this sort of like smash it all into one, COVID-19 legacy, Epstein's calendar, the CIA, and 9/11, because that pretty much covers a lot of the ground that we're getting into.
Other than music, that's where we're going. We'll try to bring it back to something we can do about it, and obviously freedom.
We do have a positive story to wrap up with, remember, at the end.
That we do. I'm looking forward to that.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and just dive on in, guys. We'll just remind you that our website is thehoustonfreethinkers.com. So if you know people based in Houston, they want to check out what we're about, see our archives, including last week's show. And you can already see the post for tonight, COVID-19 legacy, Epstein's calendar, CIA 9/11. All the links will be posted on the webpage as soon as we finish. So if you want to go back and get yourself caught up or share these stories, you can do that right there. And so let's go ahead. You know, we usually start with some stories related to Houston or Texas in general, but I think that these first couple ones here are things that will affect people across the United States and maybe across the world when it really just comes to what they actually represent. And this one, Mike, I've got two sources for this particular story, one from the Texas Tribune, another one locally from the Houston Public Media. We'll look at both of them. This one was reported about 2 weeks ago. Texas House approved sweeping limits on local regulations in GOP's latest jab at blue cities. City officials say the full scope of the legislation advanced Tuesday, a couple of Tuesdays ago, is still unclear, but it would limit their ability to issue worker protections, water restrictions, and more. So for those who don't live in Texas or know Texas, or really maybe even the United States, because this is kind of how it works, I think, across the U.S. in most places, that when they say blue cities, they're talking about the fact that in Texas, you got this big giant state. A lot of people think everybody out there rides horses and cowboys. Not everybody, but you do have the rural outside the city, even suburban folk that tend to be more conservative or Republican or just, you know, leave me alone. And then sometimes for whatever reason in the cities, you definitely have the cities more controlled, including Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, by politicians who tend to be more Democrat Party, so-called liberal, things like that. So they're claiming that this is the right-wing party, Republican Party's attack on the left-wing. I think it might be a little bit more in-depth than that if this bill is really as worrisome as they say. One thing I noticed, though, Micah, is that there's sort of this, there's concerns that they're bringing up, but they also mentioned several times in this that they actually don't know what the bill does fully because the language is unclear. So I'm not saying that doesn't mean the things they're warning about aren't true. Could be much worse. Maybe it's not as bad. Who knows? But in general, I think this is something we should be concerned with when it comes to the state trying to pass laws that, as this claims, start to limit local bodies from doing different things in their communities. And we've seen this other places. So it says here, in a major escalation of Republicans' efforts to weaken the state's bluer cities and counties, lawmakers in the Texas legislature are advancing a pair of bills that would seize control of local regulations that could range from water protections to water restrictions during droughts. The bill's backed by Governor Greg Abbott and business lobbying groups called House Bill 2127 would bar cities and counties from passing regulations and overturn existing ones that go further than state law in a broad swath of areas, including labor, agriculture, natural resources, and finance. It passed the Texas House by a 92-56 vote a couple of Wednesdays ago after clearing an initial vote. And I think the more recent article we're going to look at here in just a moment, which was just published today by the Houston Public Media, says that it's like, I think, in days away or so from the vote, and it's like looking like it's likely to pass. And it goes on from here. They quote some people who say that it's a good bill. Like this guy, State Rep Dustin Burroughs from Lubbock, says, quote, "We want those small business owners creating new jobs and providing for their families, not trying to navigate a Byzantine array of local regulations that twist and turn every time they cross city limits." Because the bill's backers say that this is needed to combat a, quote, "growing patchwork of local regulations, which make it difficult for business operators to operate and harm the state's economy." Whether you buy that argument is up to you, but that's what they're saying. They're saying Texas economic growth and jobs are overwhelmingly concentrated in the state's urban areas, and so they need to get rid of these patchwork of legislation or regulation from city to city, which I could see an argument for that, but I also could see how this could be used to, you know, go pretty far. Like, for example, when it says they're talking about like water quality, water protections, water restrictions. So would that mean like the state could prevent a local body from, say, removing fluoride from the water or something like that? It's being called unconstitutional by some people. The article goes on. You can check out for yourself. But just to see what the latest is, Houston Public Media, that it's getting nicknamed a kind of Death Star bill. Where did that quote come from? They interviewed some politician who said, okay, Hani Khalil, executive director of the Texas Gulf Coast Area Labor Federation, says that, quote, "This is a kind of Death Star bill. Local government's ability to protect tenants from slumlords could be banned. The ability to respond quickly to hurricanes and industrial fires could be banned. Many of the things we fought for, like $15 minimum wage for airport workers and for workers on county construction projects." So people have their concerns about how it's going to be used. And I encourage people to look into this to find out more about it. But that's what we got so far. Micah, what do you think about that, just based on what we're seeing at the moment?
Perpetual question that comes up on this show: what's the proper role of government here? You know, it's like kind of like a national boundary thing, if you think about it, because, you know, you got people in the local regimes here who fought for these whatevers and hope to control their lives through some local regulations and control the lives of others by passing local regulations or whatever. And you've got some people in Austin that want to do the same thing in different ways by passing or preventing passing certain regulations. So, I mean, maybe that's a trite way to look at it, you know, and I'd like to expand on that. But I mean, I do think that that is a big facet of this. You're just choosing, you know, which masters, you know, you're going to have here. You know, are you going to have the as local as possible masters, or are you going to have them on the state level? And what does it mean to have a state government? Can they say anything to a local government? I mean, is this a hierarchical thing? I must admit, the article, I think we might have talked about this once in the past, but it's relatively, I'm not familiar with it. And I was trying to absorb everything I could while you were talking about it. And I think it does come to certain things. I mean, it's all a definition of what people are allowed to do in an environment. So does it matter that Houston is this city inside of Texas in that sense? You know, what if all these rules that the state wants applied everywhere except the blue enclaves, whatever they may be? What does that mean? And what does that mean to be Texan in the face of that? I don't know, but I think there's these type of questions aren't really what the bills are about, but these type of questions are what come to the surface when you think about these bills and what they might mean for people. Is there any identity with being in this state? Is there any identity with being from these cities? Because otherwise, can't we just vote with our feet and go to a city that has more or less regulation than we want? But we know that's not really going to be the case, because when do they back down off these regulations? You know?
Yeah, so I think it does bring up some interesting questions. And, you know, I am a supporter of the idea of voting with your feet, but also sometimes there's not everybody in that position to just pick up and move, right, and go from one city to the next. And I also get the idea of like, hey, there's too much regulation. And of course, the Republicans of Texas would argue that there's too much regulation. It's all getting messy across the state. I could see how this could be like, oh, we're going to stop those whatever policies they don't like. Like, we're going to make sure that they can't have local policies supporting drag queen story time, for example. So I bet that there could be some, you know, motivation behind it.
There were things in there
as part of the culture war, you know?
Yeah, there were things in there, though, and obviously each story is going to bring up aspects of it, but there are some things in there that we would think, why would the state government even want to get in the way of, you know, workers' water breaks? They were in there, you know? And why would the state government even want to get into some of these things? And then you saw another thing was in there, like greenhouse gas emitting products, you know? And it's all a battle, like, nonstop for the ability to control minds. And, you know, I don't know how you can decide quickly on this one which is right and which is wrong. It seems like in the end you're just choosing a set of rulers. You know, I do like that, you know, this has been brought up, and I'd like to go ahead and echo it. Someone here has brought up that all the government is supposed to do is ensure that our rights are being enforced or respected, I would say. But, you know, and I appreciate that, because that's an answer, or at least, you know, that's answering to that question of what is the proper role of government, you know? So I don't know. I think that in this question that you've brought up, Derek, both sides have ones where they're doing more than that. And so with neither side being perfect,
You mean like between the left and the right?
Yeah, or with the local, you know, tyrant or the tyrant in Austin.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that generally speaking, my bias is towards like wanting the power to be as local and close as possible, because like I can get in the mayor's face and confront him and maneuver around one bodyguard, right? But the president of the United States has a whole secret service around him. I'm never going to be able to get near him to express myself, or a letter I write isn't going to go to him. And, you know, but that also, and we've talked about this before, just because it's on a local level doesn't mean it can't be even more tyrannical, maybe. But yeah, generally speaking, I think that I would probably lean towards not having the bigger body from international. Like, I don't want the UN telling the US what to do. I don't want the US telling Texas what to do. And I don't want Texas telling Houston what to do. I don't want Houston telling me what to do. You know, like, that's kind of, I guess, my hierarchy.
That's understandable. One thing I was going to say was that I think it's interesting it started in the House. It's a House bill, not a Senate bill. And that's supposed to be the set that's supposed to be, you know, closer to the people, as far as that, you know, local, you know, so it appears to be more as if, oh, this is what, you know, the representatives, not the senators, who are more, you know, elite and more typically have more money and all that sort of representation and people supporting them and their bids for power, et cetera, and backing their bills. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that bit in. It's interesting that it comes from a House bill, as if people were motivated enough to pester their representatives for this.
We got a comment here from Trish before we jump forward saying, wow, just catching this conversation. Very good point. Both sides are overstepping government's role. Appreciate all of you. You both are doing. Thank you, Trish, for that. We appreciate that. Well, we want to remind everybody, our website is thehoustonfreethinkers.com. Again, this is where you can find all of our content, all of the stuff we've been producing. If you listen on Spotify, if you want to go back and listen to the archives of us ranting and raving for the last 12 years, we don't have all 12 years archived saved, unfortunately, but we got the last couple of years. You can find us on Spotify at Live Free, Think Free. Let's go ahead and jump into this next story. As I was mentioning, this is a story that does have national and maybe international appeal. I don't know about you, Micah. I'm not sure. Maybe some of our international listeners can let us know. Does your country have something like a no-knock warrant where the cops can literally just claim that you might be a violent person or a dangerous person or have guns or something or drugs? And instead of showing up to serve a warrant like they typically would, showing up unannounced, beating down the door and guns ablaze. Like, I don't know if that's everywhere, but I know it applies across the U.S. So
it happens in Houston, and they dress like, you know, in t-shirts and shorts and stuff.
You can see this, where'd it go? There's this image, just trying to open up here, this image of this mural right here that is about a Houston case. You can see their house in the background. We've been covering this for the last few years since it happened. That is a house in Houston's East End, and you see Rest in Peace, Regina Nicholas, Dennis Tuttle. and Pet Star, all killed on January 28th, 2019, murdered by Houston Police Department. And that was the result of a no-knock warrant. So that's what that mural is about right there. But there's apparently now a bill in the Texas legislature that would create a uniform policy of banning no-knock police raids statewide and advancing the Texas legislature. Usually police announce themselves when they bust before they bust in, but under a no-knock warrant, they do this without warning. And often, as we've covered before as well, Micah, they go to the wrong houses. They end up hurting or killing the wrong people. They put themselves in harm. So Representative Gene Wu says this legislation makes sense when you consider the state's Stand Your Ground and Castle Doctrine laws, which allow people to protect their home with weapons. Wu says no-knock warrants are really dangerous. They're just a bad policy. There's no reason that you can't announce that it's police coming into your door in the middle of the night. Wu said the bill codifies what HPD has been doing. And Wu added that if no-knock warrants are necessary, officers must get permission from the police chief. And he just, referring to the shooting I just mentioned, he says, just like Harding Street, once the homeowners thought that their doors were being kicked down by home invaders, they started firing and the police responded. See, but that's actually not true. If you remember, Micah, that was all made up stuff that we found out later, that as far as we know, they actually didn't shoot back. But that's what the story was that we were being told, is that these people, remember at first it was they were drug dealers, they were dangerous. And then it was that, oh, they shot back, so HPD had killed them. Then we found out that they were killed. One of the, yes, all three at the same time, Erie Ferry, all three at the same time, same day, afternoon in their house. Dennis Tuttle, I went to the house. Dennis Tuttle was killed on his living room couch in the middle of the day while watching TV.
They lived there for 20 years, and it was on an anonymous tip and a confidential informant. And the officer that did those, basically in 100% of his raids, said there were illegal weapons, and in 0% were illegal weapons found.
Yeah, so the Houston case is total just case of corruption. So this is something that we've been calling out for a while. Wu said that people have the right, will have the right to defend their homes, or police have the right to come in unannounced. Those two things cannot exist simultaneously, he said. The bill now goes to the Senate, and if approved, would head to Governor Greg Abbott's desk to be signed into law. Wu says that there is bipartisan support. A lot of police departments in the state also changed their policy to reflect this. And I'll just mention that, you know, for those who know that I am running for mayor of Houston, that this is something that we've talked about for years and that I am talking about as a person in that race to make sure that we can talk about these deaths. And it would be cool if that was something that you didn't have to mention because, well, they couldn't do it anymore. I still think that leaving it up to the police chief, maybe that's as far as we can get without an outright ban. But, you know, I think that could still leave itself open up for abuse. But what do you think about that, Micah?
Yeah, obviously it can open itself up for abuse. Weren't they supposed to get, you know, approval and did get approval for the tunnel raid, you know? Yeah, it'd be great if such a ban were – it's ridiculous that such a ban even has to happen. I'm thinking, you know, when you say, I don't know, do y'all live in a country where this happens? Because it happens here. You know, it definitely sounds like something that would have happened like in the colonies from King George, you know, it doesn't, or in, you know, 1939 Germany or, you know, any of these kind of authoritarian regimes. So the fact that it has to be banned, I'm kind of like a little bit frustrated by that, that the common sense isn't that we serve a warrant, you know, that we took an oath to the Constitution as officers of the law and we're going to respect people's rights, you know? So I don't know.
That's unfortunately not where we're at, but I hear you. I wish that's where we're at. We'll throw out the question to the audience. If you're watching on Odyssey, Rockfin, YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, or afterwards on BitChute or Hive or any of the other places, let us know. Do you think no-knock warrants should be banned? Is that even a thing where you live? Does it sound crazy that the cops could just beat in someone's house? Yeah, and we're in Texas too, so you should expect people to probably push back every now and then. But you're listening to Live Free, Think Free, guys. We got some songs coming up, brand new song we're to debut. But before we do that, we've got a few more stories. Got some COVID news, as we have for the last 3 years. I'll let you start this one off, Micah. I know there's a new update from the Biden administration. Does it go all the way? Is it removing the end of mandates? Or what's happening here?
Definitely. I get into the story. I just am amazed sometimes with how slow these people are. Monday, Biden administration announced that it will end its COVID-19 vaccine requirements for federal workers, federal contractors, and international air travelers. So you get a government job if now without getting vaccinated. Okay, that's great news if you want to go get, you know, some government cheese or whatever, government job. But the international air travelers, that's kind of a rough one because think about it. That's just now being lifted. So if you were an American citizen and you didn't want to get vaccinated, you still couldn't go to your home. Okay? I mean, like that's kind of to drive the point home that they're just
pretty
now
nuts.
You know? The mandates, in fact, they haven't ended yet. May 11th, the same day as the public health emergency is set to expire. I hope we make it. I feel like I'm getting ready to get off grounded, you know what I mean? And I hope I don't get in trouble again. This quote came out. The federal government successfully implemented requirements for its workforce in a way that increased vaccination to achieve 98% compliance, reflecting employees who had received at least one dose of a vaccine or had a pending or approved exception or extension request filed by January 2022, the White House said. We also put in place vaccination requirements for certain international travelers to slow the spread of new variants entering the country and to allow our healthcare system time to effectively manage access to care if faced with an increase in cases and hospitalizations. The administration will also be ending corona vaccine requirements for Head Start educators, CMS certified healthcare facilities, and certain non-citizens at the land border. So, yeah, they say they'll come out with some more details. DHS, Department of Homeland Security, said Monday that it'll end its Title 19 travel restrictions on May 12th. They will no longer require non-U.S. travelers entering the United States via land ports of entry to ferry terminals to be fully vaccinated or to provide related proof of vaccination upon request. Yeah, that's really where we were. Coronavirus vaccine requirements were among the most controversial decisions from the Biden administration during the pandemic. The Pentagon in January dropped its COVID-19 vaccine mandate for the troops after Biden signed into law a massive defense spending bill that required the measure's termination, bringing a close to a contentious issue that drew considerable ire. I know we talked quite a bit while it was going on about, you know, these various mandates for government workers, for people traveling, and then, of course, you know, for people in the military and what that meant. And we had, you know, people on the show talking about that. So I guess it's good that it's coming to an end. I'm just like, I barely feel like it's newsworthy in one sense, but in another sense, it's like, this was happening to these people.
Yeah, it is still pretty nuts that that's where we were at. And I just was asking the audience, you know, did you guys even realize that there was still a COVID vaccine mandate in place? Maybe if you were in the situation you were describing, Micah, and I have, you know, since I go between Houston and Mexico, like I have friends here in Mexico, I'm like, oh man, you guys should come. And I'm like, wait, you can't even come in the country because you don't have a shot. I forget that, you know, or Canadian friends who've had to maneuver to get through the U.S. border to get back home and or just fly over it from Mexico to Canada. So these things definitely are still real. And it's crazy to imagine it has been 3 years now, 2 weeks to slow the spread, all that fun stuff that everybody jokes about, but is the reality we're facing, you know? And the next story I want to pick up from this is about vaccines as well, because look, just take that into account of what Mike is sharing there. 3 years that it's been since these restrictions, well, obviously we didn't have the vaccines right away, but it's been 3 years since the whole COVID thing began. And the restrictions have been going on for over a year now. And they're still not even done. You got another week to wait. Let's put this into perspective. They're mandating the shots for people from other countries to come to the United States. There are people who lost their jobs, obviously, not as much in the U.S. as other places, but definitely in Houston. The nurses, like Jennifer Bridges, we interviewed, lost. She was the first. That was the first hospital in the country, not just in Houston, to mandate shots for nurses. And nurses lost their job. The city of Houston mandated it for their employees. And other nations mandated it for everybody to live, basically, to go outside, to, you know, get your freedom back. And while those things are going on, the U.S. and the U.K., according to some recently released documents, and when I say recent, I mean the last couple months, but they're just kind of little bits and details. There's so many documents out there that have come out through various lawsuits. You've got like the Pfizer's dropping thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and people like Naomi Wolf are going through those at dailyclout.io trying to find little nuggets. And then groups like Judicial Watch involved in this one. So it says, in the days leading up to the U.S. FDA's approval of Pfizer's COVID vaccine, U.S. and U.K. health officials entered into a mutually confidentiality agreement to keep vaccine adverse events under wraps. And that's pretty much the gist of it right here. It says U.S. and U.K. officials discussed anaphylactoid reactions due to COVID shots and emphasized their, quote, mutual confidentiality agreement regarding the topic. This news was revealed in 57 pages of heavily redacted U.S. Department of Health and Human Services records, which were obtained via FOIA request. Government email exchange from May 14, 2021, so nearly 2 years ago, also discusses concerns about administering COVID shots along with other vaccines during pregnancies. The regulatory filings show Pfizer knew of its shots' waning effectiveness in April 2021, but didn't publicly acknowledge this till July. Preclinical studies for COVID, Pfizer's COVID shots also warned of rhabdomyolysis, which is breakdown of skeletal muscles, but the trial reported it was, quote, completed with no safety concerns. So that's kind of just gives you the brief gist of it. As I mentioned, this comes from Judicial Watch, obtained 57 pages, redacted pages from HHS, and they put in an initial FOIA request back in August 2021 for the following: all emails sent to and from members of the Vaccine and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee regarding adverse events, deaths, and or injuries caused by investigatory vaccines for the prevention or treatment of SARS-CoV-2 and or COVID-19 currently produced by Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, and or Johnson & Johnson. The request was ignored, as it often is, prompting a lawsuit that ultimately revealed the confidentiality agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. regulators. Judicial Watch President Tom Fulton says, quote, why are we engaged in a secret deal to keep secret information about adverse events related to the vaccines? I just think it's troubling. The documents speak for themselves. And these specific documents, I'll just name the names here. It says the series of emails from December 2020 initiated by Jonathan Mogford, policy director of the UK's Medicine and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, and sent to the FDA Commissioner Janet Woodcock and Peter Marks, director of the Center for Biological Evaluation and Research. And as background, Mogford includes information on two cases of anaphylactoid reactions in individuals with a strong past history of allergic reactions. Marks, who again, the director of the Center for Biological Evaluation and Research, says it would be very helpful if our Office of Vaccine could receive additional details, redacted, from the UK's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency under the terms of our mutual confidentiality agreement. Mogford later replies, attached are redacted. Hope that's helpful in the meantime. If I can just remind, information shared under our confidentiality agreement. An email exchange from May 14, 2021 also discusses concerns about COVID shots along with other vaccines during pregnancy. And, you know, it just goes on. I mean, I'm not going to read every single line here, but it's pretty telling. This is being, it was originally updated, written about by Dr. Mercola, picked up by Children's Health Defense, but originally coming from lawsuits with Judicial Watch, showing that the U.S. and U.K. apparently have some mutual confidentiality agreement. And it dealt specifically with trying to keep information secret about adverse reactions to the COVID shots. Imagine that. Can you imagine that, Micah? Government agencies working in secret?
Well, you got to ask yourself, who do these bureaucrats work for? It certainly isn't the people, not in those instances, because why would you keep that from the people? You know, it's not like we're talking about, you know, in one sense, it's not like we're talking about two companies here and they're just agreeing not to reveal that there's some defects that cause their speakers to not work in 7 years or something. You know, what we're talking about here is like human lives and human bodies. And, you know, if they're hiding results of a vaccine, I feel like there's a certain point where that kind of almost enters into fraud, you know. And I think that's an important word here, because if that can be proven, that can
crimes
be
crimes have been committed.
Yep. So, and I think people they're like, don't look here, don't look here, don't look here. And, you know, it's interesting. So you got the FDA, unelected bureaucratic body, and whatever Britain has, making these deals, you know, behind the people's backs. You know, for who are they making them for? For Pfizer and for Moderna? You know, what is
definitely not for you or me.
Yeah, I mean, so you got to ask yourself, who do all these alphabet soups really work for? And, you know, you think it's just, you know, some of the most nefarious ones, you know, like with the history of violence and doing bad things to people. I won't name that one. But, you know, people tend to think, oh, it's only these. It's only these handful of, you know, militant type
of. It's not the people I believe in.
No, it's not the little regulators who are trying to make sure that grandma's, you know, prescriptions are right. It's not. That's what they're sitting there saying. But look who we're talking about. We're talking about the FDA. So, you know, I don't know what to say about it.
I got one more to throw in, Micah. Actually, you covered this one a while back, but it's been a little bit. It might be worth refreshing people's memory before we go to a song. Just if you want to remember all the crazy things that happened during COVID, you got confidentiality agreements. You remember this one, Micah?
That I do. That I do. I remember just thinking that it was, I guess I'd say that it was just something that most people wouldn't think could happen here. And, you know, we were going to talk about this in a past episode. I think it's good to go ahead and talk about it now. But just so people know what was done, because yesterday, COVID, who knows what will be done in the future, right? Santa Clara County in California deployed a variety of surveillance techniques on congregants of a church because they met during COVID-19. They included, you're going to love these, tracking phone location data and parking a car in a nearby lot to observe behavior. I'm sure there were people in this car, right? These people were what, government employees out during COVID? What they're saying not to do so they can track the people going to a church during COVID. Inspectors from the county's business compliance unit spent a total of 51 hours conducting stakeouts near the Calvary Chapel, San Jose, between November 25th and January 3rd of 2021, observing everything from Sunday services to baptisms and prayer groups. Enforcement officers, you're going to love this part. Now, this is where you really come out ahead. Enforcement officers who were paid $219 an hour, hey, it was COVID, wrote in great detail about church activities, noting each violation of the mask mandate. Think of that little hall monitor out there. They're out there singing and baptizing people and playing guitars and stuff. And this little hall monitor at $219 an hour is like, that mask wasn't on little Bobby Jr. there. And when they dropped something, the mask came awry. Oh, goodness. Using cellular mobility data from a company called SafeGraph, which aggregates location data from 47 million devices nationwide to show movement patterns, the county also set up a geofence around the church building to track how many people visited each day, documents show. The county paid a Stanford law professor, you'll love this one, his name is Daniel Ho. So they paid Ho $800 an hour to analyze the data. That's right. $800 an hour for him to analyze the data. Determined this law professor determined that there was a daily peak of 1,700 people visiting. I mean, you needed someone at $800 an hour to figure that one out. Oh, God. It doesn't end, though, you know. It's really kind of unconscionable how much money was spent on that. And I guess, I don't know. I guess they said that the persistent surveillance of the church services made people believe that the county was going to order the police to arrest them for attending church.
So crazy.
Yeah, they ended up, the county is currently seeking $2.87 million in public health fines from the chapel in an ongoing lawsuit. How do you like that?
So crazy, man. Well, it's important, though. This is why we cover these stories, because I know that there's still people trying to dissect what happened during COVID as we are. And it's important when we have these moments of recognition of like, wow, or new revelations coming out in documents, which I think we're going to get for years to come, that truth is not forgotten, because there's so many people who are not told that truth. Guys, you've been listening to Live Free, Think Free for the last 30 minutes or so. We're going to go to a music break. I want to play a clip, though, on our way out to this song, Micah, just to mark today is World Press Freedom Day, for those who don't know. World Press Freedom Day. And the White House has made statements about this, the U.S. State Department speaking out about journalists who've been prosecuted in other countries. But for some reason today, State Department spokesman Vedant Patel, when he was asked by Associated Press reporter Matt Lee about Assange, he didn't want to talk about that. So let's check out that clip, and then we're going to go to a brand new song from Total Chaos called Welcome to the New World Order. We'll be right back, guys. You've been listening to Live Free, Think Free.
Do you believe that he's a journalist or not? Matt, I'm just not going to offer a prescriptive assessment from here. Our view on Mr. Assange, our view on Mr. Assange is that he's been charged with serious criminal conduct in the United States.
Anyone can be charged with anything. You know, Evan Gershkovich has been charged with serious criminal offense in Russia, and you say that he's a journalist, and he is, obviously, and I just want to know whether or not you, the State Department, regardless of any charges that he faces, believe that he is a journalist or he is something else?
Well, first I would say, Matt, that these two cases are very, very different.
Of course, they're completely different. But
the United States doesn't go around arbitrarily detaining people. Judicial oversight and checks and balances that we have in our system versus the Russian system are a little bit different. But again, I'm not here to offer a specific assessment. What I will say is that he's been charged with a serious crime, with serious criminal conduct in the United States that has seriously put in harm's way U.S. national security. And that continues to be the case.
Okay, so basically the bottom line is that you don't have an answer. You won't say whether you think...
I've sufficiently answered your question, Matt. As I've said, we believe that he has been charged with serious criminal conduct
for yourself,
in the United States.
But not for me. Okay.
Order.
good. Rockefeller's passing around. I heard that.
Yeah. The Thought Police are coming for me. I heard that too. Yeah, that was Total Chaos, old school punk band. If you don't know them and you enjoy that kind of music, go check them out. Been around for decades. They're about to start touring Europe in a couple of weeks from what I was told today. And that song has never before been played on the airwaves or on the internet waves until just then. It's called Welcome to the New World Order, and it's going to be coming off their new album. I don't know the name of it even, but it'll be out pretty soon apparently. So check that out. And remind you guys that thehoustonfreethinkers.com is the best place to keep up with us. I believe there's a contact page on this website if you need to reach out to us. If not, yeah, there's a little email you can see right here that'll send you to get in touch with us. If you want to send in songs that you are listening to or jamming, we always try to find things that are not going to be, that are not going to be found on all the airwaves out there that you could listen to anywhere. You know, we strive to find not only news and things you're not going to hear on the mainstream, like underground news, but also music, things that you might not find on other airwaves or on other radio stations. The only other person I know, Micah, who does something similar to what we do here with this show, I'm not sure if you follow his work or know him, but James, not James Corbett, but James, the other James, who James Corbett partners with, they do a weekly thing called the New World This Week. Well, other James, his last name is escaping me right now, his thing's called Media Monarchy, and he basically has like his own online radio station where he plays all kinds of, you know, old school music, new school stuff, just all kinds of things while reporting on the news too. So I don't know if there's too many other people trying to combine music and news in the way that we're trying to do here, and maybe in the ways that some radio stations used to do back in the day, but don't seem to do anymore.
Yeah, I don't seem to find it when I've been riding around in a car that has the HD tuners and such. So I'm checking out all these HD stations underneath, like the flagship stations, you know, on FM. That's been kind of interesting, but not that interesting.
Not that interesting. All right, guys. Well, we're going to try to keep it interesting for you. We'll go ahead and jump into some more news. Again, the website, thehoustonfreethinkers.com, for all of our archives and such. Micah, you got one here about the Supreme Court up to something.
I do. I got one about the Supreme Court, and I'm going to go through it pretty quick, but I think it hides and shows just that, you know, how big, you know, the Leviathan government is, and how so many little things happen in compartments and in places we don't know about and are used to, you know, control people and to get your way. And I think that, you know, oftentimes people aren't aware of these things. So I thought I would bring this story because I hadn't heard of judicial deference. And that's what this is about. The Supreme Court agreed to hear this case and people were shocked about it. So I'm like, why were people shocked about it? The case is called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. And this is a case which could see an end to Chevron deference. This is a situation where a court defers to a federal agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute. I'll repeat that. This is where the courts, they listen to one of those alphabet soups, interpretation of something ambiguous in a statute, okay? And didn't we just talk about who we think these alphabet soups seem to serve more than not? I don't know. Maybe people could have a different view of them and actually think they're, you know, serving the people. I don't know. But that's what it is. Chevron deference, in which courts defer to a federal agency's interpretation of a statute. This case involves Loper Bright Enterprises. It's a family-owned herring fishing company, and it's up in the New England area. National Marine Fishery Services regulation requires that herring fishing boats allow an additional person on board to serve as a monitor for tracking compliance with federal regulations. The monitor's salary must be paid by the fishing company being monitored. So you got to take this thing on, and you got to pay for its existence. Reducing fishing profits in a business where margins are very tight. Loper Bright Enterprises and other fishing companies sued, you know, what else could they do? They said the Magnuson-Stevens Act doesn't mention payment of the monitor. But the district court ruled against the industry. A divided panel in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the agency had appropriately interpreted the statute, deferring under the Chevron framework. Judge Justin Walker, however, dissented, arguing that Congress did not authorize the National Marine Fisheries Services to make herring fishermen in Atlantic pay the wages of federal monitors. And I think, I don't know, there's something that just seems to ring probable in that statement. Again, he argued that Congress did not authorize the National Marine Services, the National Marine Fisheries Services, and you could substitute any alphabet soup there, to make, and you could substitute any group of Americans, herring fishermen in the Atlantic, pay the wages of the federal monitors. The Supreme Court has an opportunity to correct one of the most consequential judicial errors in a generation. Chevron deference has proven corrosive to the American system of checks and balances and directly contributed to an unaccountable executive branch, overbearing bureaucracy, and runaway regulation, Cause of Action Institute counsel Marion Mulvey said. And the counsel of record, Paul Clement, concurred, and he said, "We look forward to that day in court." Bill Bright, a New Jersey fisherman and plaintiff in the case, explained that the justices hold his way of life in their hands. I mean, let's get it real. I mean, it's tough for everybody, right? And this is what's tough for him right now. We hope they'll keep our families and our community in mind as they weigh in on their decision, Bright said in a statement to the press. After examining over 140 recent appellate cases, which were filed amicus brief in this case, the Cato Institute concluded that courts of appeals still defer under Chevron with regularity, despite the Supreme Court's increasing reluctance to invoke the doctrine. Chevron will not fade away completely until the Supreme Court overrules it.
So, Michael, what's the main takeaway of how this thing is used? Like, I think I kind of grasp it, but maybe you could dumb it down for me. Like, the Chevron thing is, it's because they're saying they're worried that it's going to go away.
Take the fishing example. These guys had a fishing company, herring fishing, right? You heard the little story, right? They're out there. They have to pay for this guy to come on their boat to make sure they follow the rules now. So now they have an extra person. These boats aren't huge. I mean, I'm sure you can see them on cable. Maybe, you know, a few people in the operation. Now you got another guy, and who knows? I mean, if a guy gets paid, what was it, $219 an hour to watch churchgoers, who knows what a guy on a fishing vessel gets paid? And at the expense of the fishermen. And so that's what it is. And this thing where they sued because, you know, they can't afford that, the court turned for the definition of the statute to the very entity that's doing that, that's getting paid to be there. So you got a bureaucracy telling
them, I mean, even the name
regulation means.
The name Chevron deference, though, probably comes literally from a case where they deferred to Chevron.
You could check it out. I do not know, but it's judicial deference or Chevron deference.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, I'm just going, I mean, like I said, I do want to look into this. If anybody knows more, please chime in for us. But it says, it's which courts defer to a federal agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute. So I wonder if it like originated from some case against Chevron or where it comes from. But interesting nonetheless. So it's trying, if it moves in a positive direction, there would at least be some clarity on how this thing
just
works.
Like, right? Just like there's Tide, laundry soap, and Cheer. These words meant something besides that. And it's the same thing with the Chevron. It means something besides just that company's name. So I don't know. I did try to find that out, and it wasn't a quick one. And you think that if it were, it'd be a quick one, you know, like the Exxon Valdez one. You know, people know about that case. But nonetheless, it'd be interesting if you found more on that. So, yeah.
Yeah, actually, it does appear to relate to it here. I just while we're on it, might as well just share it with everybody. So this one, Chevron USA Incorporated versus Natural Resources Defense Council Incorporated, was a landmark case in which the U.S. Supreme Court set forth the legal test for determining whether to grant deference to a government agency's interpretation of a statute which it administers, from 1984. So, yeah, I'd be curious to just learn more about that. But, yeah, it does say that the Supreme Court is getting ready to hear a case about that power, and we'll see how that plays out. Interesting. I've never heard of that. So learning new things here on the show. And we got a couple of other stories that are now getting to the other creepy part of our headline, which we talked about COVID legacy a little bit, but that is the Mr. Jeffrey Epstein. There's some new news coming out this week from the Wall Street Journal related to Epstein. I know you got this report from Daily Wire, and I got another one to follow this up about Jamie Dimon, JP Morgan Chase, and his ongoing legal battles relating to Jeffrey Epstein. But before we do that, I want to play just a quick 10-second clip from Biden's administration's press secretary being asked why the current CIA director was meeting with Jeffrey Epstein after he was already been convicted of sex crimes. And let's see what she has to say.
President Biden have any reaction to CIA Director William Burns meeting with Jeffrey Epstein in 2014? This obviously was after Epstein had served time for a sex crime and registered as a sex offender.
Just not going to comment on that from here.
We're just not going to comment. So since they won't comment, why don't we comment, Michael? I'll let you start ahead and I'll pick up where you leave off.
You know, I couldn't pass it up. Maybe it was clickbait. I don't know. But I was like, huh? Not surprising. But why? I'll go ahead and try to understand the reason behind this. But yeah, sure enough. And he met him at his personal house and stuff. And this was after he was, you know, convicted. But let's get into the story. On Sunday, it was reported that Burns met with Epstein three times in 2014. And want to remind everybody that he pled guilty in 2008 to procuring for prostitution a minor. So come on. I think everybody had kind of already known that he was what he was, right? And okay. So the Burns met with him three times in 2014 and once at his townhome. Epstein, of course, received a, you know, what is it, a sweetheart prison sentence in exchange for his plea. And everybody, like I said, knew who he was in 2014. Well, almost everybody, because Burns says he didn't. From 2011 to 2014, Burns was United States Deputy Secretary of State. He served Secretary of State for Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama. Now a spokesperson for the public servant told the journal that he had no idea who Epstein was during that time. Burns like, I don't know who he is. CIA spokeswoman Tammy Kupperman Thorpe said in a statement to the paper that the director did not know anything about him other than he was introduced as an expert in the financial services sector and offered general advice on transition to the private sector. They had no relationship. Right. That doesn't exactly exude much confidence in Burns' competence, right? What sort of high-ranking government official has several meetings, once in D.C. and twice in Epstein's New York City townhome, without running a background check on the individuals accompanying them? I mean, this is a, you know, high-ranking guy. Of course, rumors and conspiracy theories have long suggested that Epstein was secretly working for either the CIA itself or a foreign intelligence agency. There has been no concrete proof of that, at least this is what this article says, but there hasn't really been any solid explanation for what exactly Epstein did and how he was able to run his business by pimping out underage girls to prominent individuals from around the globe for so long. Burns was confirmed to the CIA in March of 2021 and should have to explain why he was really meeting Epstein in 2014. I think that might surprise a few people. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard
crazy
to know.
Stuff.
It's not like anybody couldn't meet this guy once he's out there. I'm not trying to defend a CIA guy, but like at the same time, it is possible, but we got a CIA person saying, oh, he didn't know who it was. He met him three times and it never occurred to this the head of the CIA now or whatever to check out who he's meeting. It doesn't seem to jive right with the nature of that person. It's like pretending that someone who, you know, follows baseball doesn't know the next game coming up in their hometown.
Yeah. And I'll just, in case we haven't said this is all originally being reported by the Wall Street Journal, picked up by the Daily Wire and many other places, as Micah was just reporting. The original one, which was just published a couple days ago, was titled Epstein's Private Calendar Reveals Prominent Names, Including CIA Chief Goldman's top lawyer, and people like Noam Chomsky, who is now clear he was on his schedule to fly and have dinner with Epstein in 2015. And as you said, Mike, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, right? Chomsky doesn't really do himself any favors, I will say, in this article. Let me just pull up his response, because he's pretty much like, it's none of your business who I want to hang out with. And again, maybe he's correct about that. But he said, the interesting thing is, though, he's meeting as well with Ehud Barak, which is a former prime minister of Israel. Epstein arranged this meeting with Mr. Barak to, quote, discuss Israel's policies with regard to Palestinian issues in the international arena. They also met in New York. And, he says that Epstein would bring interesting people for him to meet. When asked about his relationship with Epstein, Mr. Chomsky replied in an email, first response is that it's none of your business or anyone's. Second is that I knew him and we met occasionally. So there's, that. And then just today, there was another second piece from these young journalists. They're reporting this. I watched an interview with them. This is the second one. Jeffrey Epstein documents part two, dinners with Lawrence Summers and movie screenings with Woody Allen. And it goes deeper into that about the former Treasury Secretary and one-time Harvard president, university president, meeting with Jeffrey Epstein many times for philanthropy money for his wife's charity or nonprofit. So, there's a lot more that I'm sure is to come. This is, they say, part two. They don't seem to indicate this is the end. So I think there's going to be more names being named in this. And kind of a sidebar ongoing to this, we have these updates with the Jamie Dimon situation. Jamie Dimon, of course, of J.P. Morgan Chase. His institution is being sued by the Virgin Islands, because that's where Epstein's island was based, saying that J.P. Morgan Chase basically was the bank that Epstein used to funnel his payments to his abuse victims through, and that J.P. Morgan Chase was using Epstein as a client, knowing that this was going on. Just like these people meeting with him, J.P. Morgan Chase had his bank account even after the sex assault charges became public and things of that sort. So, and that's a whole scene. We could talk about that for several minutes if we chose to. But basically, the latest news is that Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, is actually, this was about a month ago, but the news today that's just reported here, actually, let's just go ahead and search Jamie Dimon Epstein live while we're doing it live. I believe today it came out that he is going to be deposed. Here's a news report from CNBC, deposition of JP Morgan CEO Dimon in Jeffrey Epstein lawsuits set for late May, source says. So that information, if it is made public, is, you can imagine, going to be pretty salacious and interesting to a lot of people. But you also have JP Morgan, another official, Mr. Jess Staley, JP Morgan's former investment banking chief, who is also being sued and kind of pursued. It seems like JP Morgan Chase is pretty much dumping it all on him and saying, he was in charge, he made the wrong decisions. And so there's still lots to come. And I think that all of this is really relating to Epstein's allegedly dead. Lots of people don't believe that, but they're trying to figure out who else played the role, right? If it wasn't just Epstein acting alone, you got Ghislaine Maxwell, well, she's in prison. Jean-Luc Brunel, the guy who was involved with the models, he got caught in France. Different people have been caught, and now they're going after, well, they didn't do this alone. They were using different bank accounts. They had different help from Wall Street, and who knew them and who's connected. So overall, we're getting more pieces of the puzzle. I think it's important whether we're going to find out the whole truth. I guess that remains to be seen. But what do you think about all this, Micah? I mean, like we said, the CIA guy, maybe no surprise, maybe it's harmless, maybe it doesn't mean anything, but it does have relevance because, as the other article said, Epstein has long been suspected of intelligence connections, and not, we don't have the document that says here's Epstein's CIA profile, but we do have government officials saying Epstein was left alone because he was working in intelligence. That came from Donald Trump's former labor secretary, Alexander Acosta. Whenever he was being confirmed, he was told, because he was part of the sweetheart deal back in Florida. And he said he was told when they were going after Epstein that he had some sort of intelligence protection. So, that's what we know.
I think that obviously it's a organization. Like, it's organized what he was doing. It's organized. Yeah. And
organized crime.
As it's organized, we're not talking about like, there was a guy across town who just abused six people or something like that. Like, I knew a couple of weeks back we covered human trafficking was uncovered, right? Like, that's gone. We don't even know who those people driving that van that had a human trafficking people in the back being trafficked were. You know, it's not like no, this is some guy who ran around in these circles of social circles of high ranking people that think of themselves as elite people in politics, that sort of thing. And how he insinuated himself in those circles, it seems pretty diverse. I think it's obvious that there's more pieces to it, at least in the financial aspect. That, you know, people could go into the whole thing about him, you know, it's a joke, you know, don't get Epstein'd, you know, like, so that's, you could call it a conspiracy theory or whatever there, but that's a whole different chapter than this one here, where we're talking about trying to chase the money and see who benefited. If he was an intelligence operative, even if he was, let's say he was some kind of crazy independent rogue, because they love to use that word, right? Rogue. He wasn't with us. We had dealings, but not really. He might have been like, you know, let's just call him that, this rogue operative who made different deals and blackmailed different officials, perhaps. But even that, why wouldn't people want us to dig into that? Well, what were they being blackmailed for? You get what I mean? Everything, all the money is going to point to different potential violations of people.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like you said, like, there's so many angles to the Epstein story, and I think that's why it does fascinate people. I'll mention one other thing about that for those who know her work, Whitney Webb over at unlimitedhangout.com. Following the Wall Street Journal's reporting, she published a new article specifically looking into the Epstein Chomsky relationship through MIT, because that's where Chomsky comes out of, and Epstein gave a lot of money to MIT and other officials who were involved in that and connected to that, and who have also been, including, you know, relationships with Chomsky, friends of Chomsky, who've been accused of abuse. And it's interesting. So I encourage you to go unlimitedhangout.com if you want to see Whitney Webb's latest on that.
There's people saying Jamie Dimon's going to be all right, though, Derek. There's people saying Jamie's just going to be fine now that he's got, you know, most of the assets of First Republic Bank in Chase's hands. You know, I don't know. I think it's interesting that these things
happen. Well, that's what I'm saying. There's so much happening, right? And maybe there's always things, but you got these banks making moves, and the bigs getting bigger, as you said before, right? So they're just swallowing up more banks. And for those who have been paying attention to that, just briefly before we get to our last story, the financial machinations happening the last couple months, the banks that have been collapsed, or that we've been told have collapsed, that have been bought up or salvaged by the government or other companies, their total revenue is bigger than the banks that collapsed in 2008. That's what I've been seeing more people pay attention to, is like, hey, this is a bigger, these banks going down is much bigger than what happened in 2008. What that means for what's coming, I can't tell you, but I do think it's interesting that the banks are going, they're getting gone after because of the Epstein stuff. They're being accused of plenty of other things, and they're getting bigger. They're getting bigger in the background. Well, our last story for the night, Micah, I wanted to just briefly cover this. I actually interviewed today the journalist who wrote this. This is floridabulldog.org. They're like a local independent news station. One of their big topics they've covered for years has been 9/11. And this is about a few weeks old. You might have seen it going around, but I wanted to talk to one of the people who actually was the first to report on it. The title is Ex-FBI Agents Accuse Top CIA FBI Officials of 9/11 Cover-Up. CIA said to use Saudis and others for illegal domestic spy operations. So obviously some big claims there. And so we're going to go to an interview now with journalist Dan Christensen of the Florida Bulldog, who's the gentleman who actually wrote that article there. We're going to go ahead and just check out what he has to say, and we will be right back, guys. Please stay tuned. We're talking with Dan Christensen of the Florida Bulldog about this new update in the ongoing 9/11 story, the pursuit of justice in the 9/11 saga. This report that just came out a couple of weeks ago, Dan, it's talking about this investigator for the Office of Military Commissions, Donald Canestraro, I believe might be how you say his name, yes. Part of the DOD's Military Commissions Defense Organization. These are some new, not new documents, but newly redacted documents, or, you know, a copy that is unredacted now made public by the website Spy Talk. And you did some reporting on this. Can you tell us what is the main takeaway of these new documents that people should know about?
Well, the main takeaway is that it's coming from a whole new source of information, and that is the Guantanamo detention trials down there. In the past, there had been nothing that had been coming out of the Guantanamo about 9/11, and you know, any of the details of what happened. This particular document was picked up. I don't know how Spy Talk got it. It was leaked apparently to them by somebody, and I heard about it and ended up reporting on the details that were inside of this. And this Don Canestrero guy, who is an investigator, who's essentially a private investigator hired by the Defense Department or paid by the Defense Department as a to work for the defense team for a guy named Amar al-Baluchi, who was a Pakistani citizen who's awaiting trial with four other men who were accused of planning the 9/11 attacks. He's the, I believe it's the brother-in-law of the alleged mastermind of the crimes. And the document, besides the fact of where it comes from, the document's remarkable for a couple of reasons. The most significant thing is it contains interviews with 11 former FBI agents, two ex-CIA agents, and some others. And the account they tell supports the truth of a long public but somewhat unknowable and highly disturbing allegations that top CIA officials at the time, including CIA Director George Tenet, had intentionally withheld vital intelligence from the FBI that might have prevented 9/11 in the first place. Specifically, that two future hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazami and Khalid al-Midar, had entered the United States in Los Angeles in January of 2000, shortly after attending what the intelligence community was describing as a summit of al-Qaeda leadership, at which apparently the 9/11 attacks and the attack on the USS Cole had been discussed. So that's sort of the gist of this, but a lot of this hasn't been explored before. Notably, the idea here that the CIA was working domestically inside the United States through a sponsor organization, essentially the CIA of Saudi Arabia, to try and recruit Hazmi and Midar, these two hardcore al-Qaeda guys, suicide hijackers, to be informants for the CIA.
Didn't turn out
pretty well, if that's the truth.
Let's talk about that for a moment. Obviously, that's not the version of events that most Americans have heard or are led to believe about the 9/11 attacks, that there would be any sort of CIA or intelligence connection or relationship with any of the alleged hijackers. Do you think that this story is getting enough coverage in the American media right now? Or is this?
No, it's getting no coverage, frankly. Florida Bulldog is a very small news operation. I mean, I've been a reporter down here for since the late 1970s. And I'm the only actual employee of the company. I've got five or six other people who work with us as editors and reporters, who are all very experienced people. But we're a small organization. You know, where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post on this story? That's where people were killed. This is a local story, in addition to being an international story for them. And yet they've chosen to ignore both this document and ignore thousands, literally thousands of pages that have been declassified by the FBI over the last year in response to a presidential executive order issued by President Biden regarding an FBI program called Operation Encore, in which they looked at Saudi involvement or possible Saudi involvement in 9/11 and conducted an investigation that went on for years. One of the reasons that we're involved in this is we first learned about Operation Encore through litigation, Freedom of Information Act litigation that we had filed down here against the FBI, and they released the first document about it to us back in 2016. It was so secret at the time that they blacked out the name Operation Encore. They didn't even say what it was, but what they did say was a number of extremely intriguing things, putting together various people whose identities had been known before with others who worked at the Saudi embassy in Washington, and indicating that they were taking orders in dealing with these two future hijackers from the Saudi embassy in Washington. And all that is going to figure extremely prominently in this very large civil suit that's been going on for 20 years in which the victims, family members, businesses, survivors of 9/11 have sued Saudi Arabia seeking zillions of dollars.
Let's talk about some other aspects of the of these new documents here. There are claims by some of the people interviewed by Mr. Canestraro claiming that the CIA was spying on the FBI and generally just not doing things that are probably legal. Can you talk to us more about that, these accusations by these FBI agents against the CIA?
Yeah, to me, they were quite shocking. They were essentially saying that after 9/11, they were saying that in advance of 9/11, the CIA would not tell the FBI what the heck was going on, that they knew about paid terrorists, these two in particular, that became hijackers. And they were, by the way, they were aboard the plane that flew into the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. In addition to obstructing knowledge of that and keeping it from the FBI until very late in August of 2001, they also, apparently after the attacks, according to several of these people that were not named but are known to investigator Canestraro, or he says in his sworn statement that was filed in his, you know, client's case, that he knows these people, but he's not disclosing to the public who they are. But they are, he describes them, and they says that they have, they're very senior people. And they said that the CIA afterwards ultimately began spying on the FBI, planting, with the FBI's apparent approval, planting their CIA agents in FBI offices around the country, and sounded, certainly the way I read it, as if they were trying to control the investigation into 9/11, the FBI's investigation into 9/11. It was quite disturbing information.
So there's mention of interviews with former Deputy National Security Advisor Richard Clark, as well as Senator Bob Graham, and particularly Richard Clark uses the term false flag in his discussions in these interviews. Could you tell us what that was all about?
Yeah. First of all, Senator Graham's comments seemed to be quite limited and were made in 2016. And they basically went to the idea that when he was the head or the co-chairman of Congress's joint inquiry to 9/11, which preceded the 9/11 commission, lasted for about a year, he has felt all along that the FBI was and the CIA were less than forthcoming to Congress in describing what happened. As a matter of fact, that's how I got involved with him, because working with an Irish journalist named Anthony Summers, who wrote a book called The 11th Day, was published with his wife, Robin Swan, about 9/11, which, by the way, is an excellent summary of what happened. I had nothing to do with that book. But I've known Tony Summers for a long time. He contacted me in August of 2011, on the 10th anniversary, right as the book was about to be published, or being published, had already gone to press, about a lead that they had in Florida, which involved hijackers being connected with a Saudi family over in the Sarasota area, which is on the west coast of Florida. And that's about 10 miles from Venice, Florida, which is the airport, or one of the airports, where Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Sheikhi, who was the pilot that flew into the South Tower of the World Trade Center, had trained. And I met him because I met the senator because we were the first to tell, Tony and I were the first ones to tell him about what had happened over in Sarasota, that there had been an FBI investigation into that was secret, that was apparently not part of this Operation Encore. It was another investigation that was kept secret from Congress. And, he, from that and his own experiences, taking testimony from FBI officials, CIA officials, he came to the conclusion that they were not honest with, they were not being forthcoming with what they knew about this. Because part of what also came out in this Don Canestrello's report was that while it focuses mainly on the FBI's faults, there was some criticism by these former FBI agents of the FBI upper echelon, too, that they hid things, that they were told things about, what was happening. And that they also, for instance, the agents in Washington, one agent in Washington claimed that they were ordered not to interview any Saudis during their post 9/11 investigation. And the Saudis, there were a number of Saudis living in Washington at the time, people that worked at the embassy that could have been interviewed that apparently were not because of that order. Richard Clark, who was the former deputy national security advisor during the Bush administration and at over 9/11, said that prior to the attacks, he had been told by the deputy chief of the CIA, Kofor Black, that the CIA had not managed to obtain any inside sources with Al-Qaeda. They hadn't penetrated Al-Qaeda at all, so they didn't know what was going on with them. And according to Clark, this is according to the statement that he gave to Mr. Canestrello, and he said this before publicly, that there was essentially a false flag operation in which a guy named Omar al-Bayoumi, who was a suspected Saudi intelligence agent based in San Diego, who had contact with the hijackers prior to 9/11. And he befriended them. He helped them get an apartment. He helped them set up bank accounts, that sort of thing. That he was also reporting on their activities back to Saudi intelligence, who was also working with the CIA. And apparently, according to Mr. Clark, that the information that went to the Saudi intelligence also went to the CIA. And again, that's pretty disturbing when you realize that these men were later part of the hijacking team that tried to take out the Pentagon.
Yeah, these are definitely a different version of events than what most Americans are being taught or told. And definitely, as you mentioned earlier, this story, these reports, these documents are not getting any mainstream coverage from the major networks and the major papers of the day. As to why that might be, we can leave the viewers to speculate. But one last question before we wrap up, Dan. What do you think is just a good takeaway from this overall, besides, you know, what we've just emphasized, that this is a different version of events. This is important because of the CIA's involvement, because of obviously the results of 9/11 and the impact of 9/11 and what's happened in the last 20 years to our world since then. But what would you say is a takeaway that someone who is hearing about this and is not hearing about this in the mainstream, that they might take with them?
I think that this is the kind of documentation that could lead to that if there is some sort of public pickup on it. I have heard, and I intend to be writing soon, a story to that effect, that there are people within the 9/11 family community that would like to see this, and the documentation that's come out because of President Biden's order, which literally, as I said, are thousands of pages. I still haven't read them all. And I try to follow this stuff pretty closely, but I cover local news in Florida in addition to 9/11. So I just simply haven't had a time to do this. But there's all these documents out there. They're mostly uncensored. They have some very interesting things to say. And if you go to floridabulldog.org and you run 9/11, you can see a lot of the stories that I have written over the last year and a half since these documents were first released. They're released in a number of different batches that talk about all sorts of things that haven't come up before, people haven't heard before. For instance, one of the things that I find the most interesting was there was a videotape that the FBI had obtained of Hazmi and Midar, those future hijackers, at Los Angeles International Airport. And they apparently were there with some other interesting people and that the FBI wanted to get a line on. They even wanted to go public with this, but they couldn't convince Washington to make this video public. They were hoping to get some leads as to who these other people were that they were dealing with. There's information about a Saudi prince or princes that were involved with the people that they wanted to question. So all these interesting things that are happening in this case, or have happened in this case, these are all in recent years, but none of it's come out pretty much except for the Bulldog. We're the only ones that are reporting on it, which is pretty sad.
Well, we appreciate your work, Dan, and that you're doing over there at the Bulldog, and for staying on these documents. And we look forward to future reporting on this. I would encourage everybody to check out the website, floridabulldog.org, for this report that we're discussing today, as well as the many numerous reports you've done over the years. And I'll also include in the description today's show an interview we did together, I think back in 2018, with previous developments in this ongoing story. And I'm sure we'll talk soon once we get more information. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Okay. Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. We'll be right back. Everyone, please stay tuned. All right. So that was an interview with Dan Christensen of floridabulldog.org. And yeah, the noise there was a little bit of his. I think he had like a mic on his shirt or something. So please forgive that. But hopefully you got that information. It's very important related to 9/11. And that will be posted on the HoustonFreethinkers.com as well as all the Conscious Resistance channels if you want to just watch that slice of information. But yeah, that's pretty much, what do you think about that, Micah? Just that story, what he's covering, and the fact that, like he said, it's not getting any mainstream coverage.
We talked about this before, information coming out in little pieces and over time. I don't know. Maybe more people will start researching it. We were a generation later since the events. It's hard for people, it's hard for me to imagine that people, I guess if you were born in the last decade, maybe you just accept the, mainstream narrative on this as a whole. I don't know. I imagine most people who question it would want to dig into it, and you'd have to.
I know that my younger brother was born in 1997, so he was like 3 and a half or something like that when it happened. So he, has no memory of that, and sort of learned once he got to school, right? They start teaching him about what happened when they were a little kid. And so he's told me before that it's like not a thing that anybody in his generation pays attention to or thinks about.
Yeah, and they don't think about how things were seen differently, you know, with regards to rights and that sort of stuff before. And
exactly. They don't have a reference to that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, guys, it's been an hour and a half with you, so we hope you've enjoyed this show. You've been listening to Live Free, Think Free. We just played an interview with journalist Dan Christensen. We played some clips earlier of the State Department not wanting to talk about Assange, State Department not wanting to talk about Biden, CIA director being connected to Epstein. And we talked about COVID and mandates coming to an end. Maybe we talked about the U.S. and the U.K. government keeping secret COVID injuries. Not one to talk. And we're going to end, though, this final one, just a quick one before we're out of here, with something more positive. Micah, you found this. And it's funny because it's from notthebee.com, which I guess it's saying, like, this is not the Babylon Bee. These are real stories. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's at least what they're saying. And this one came, you know, it came from a study. I don't know. I just picked it up a while back and kind of thought, oh, it's interesting. And there's the British Journal of Sports Medicine kind of has the bulk of this story as well about the study. They're the ones who did it. And there's a link to that in the story. You can get all that at HoustonFreethinkers.com. But so they say more than 128,000 participants were analyzed from the University of South Australia. And it suggests, imagine this, that exercise should be the primary treatment for depression, anxiety, and other common mental health conditions. What about that? The study found that 12-week or shorter exercise interventions reduced mental health symptoms the most. They said that mental health disorders are, it was compared with like even drug treatments. Physical activity is known to help improve mental health, says the doctor. Yet, despite the evidence, is not widely adopted as a first choice treatment. Singh and his colleagues at the university conducted a broad study and called it an umbrella review to take the broadest ever look at the issue. An umbrella review examines a wide collection of existing studies to provide an overall picture of the total sum of research about a subject. So the research team extracted all the eligible studies published prior to 2022 from 12 databases. Overall, they analyzed 97 reviews that include 1,039 trials with more than 128,000 participants. When comparing the effects of exercise to those of usual care across all populations, they found that exercise improved symptoms of depression, anxiety, and psychological distress 1.5 times better than talk therapy or medication. So I don't know. Sometimes you might want to think about that when you get down, you get anxious. I don't know. I just thought that was, you know, pretty interesting. The study found that all types of physical activity and exercises were beneficial. Aerobic exercises such as walking, resistance training, Pilates, yoga. Imagine that. That's right.
Very cool. Yeah, it's cool to see it's a big review because I've heard of other individual studies saying similar conclusions. So it's cool to see there's data to support that.
Yeah, 1.5 times more effective at treating it than getting therapy or drugs. And that's not saying there's not extreme cases, you know, where people need their meds and they need to get medicated. But
you know what's best for you, not us, but you might want to at least consider exercise, right?
Yeah, you know, and I think it was interesting coming out, you know, on the at the tail end of COVID and all this stuff, like the value of getting out and going for a walk. I don't know. You know, like I said, this was an older story that we were going to bring in, but the facts remain, you know, and maybe it was a little more crucial then, but maybe someone hearing it today recognizes that it is crucial. And remember, it said any exercise, so you know, a good way to start is going for a walk. Maybe curls, maybe doing some weights, crunches. I don't know. But
jumping jacks.
If you're not ready for SEAL training, maybe you just take the dog for a walk or get out more before it gets super hot. I hope you all take care of yourselves until next week. It's been a good episode, Derek. I've enjoyed it.
It's been a good one. Yeah, lots of Jamie Dimon. Tell us about this song we're closing with, Micah. We got Bad Seed. Tell me about this. We're closing with it.
This is a Houston band. I saw them out at the Ganesha Carswell release party, and they just tore up. They jammed on stage, and I've heard a few of their things online. I checked them out, and so I brought this one. And if y'all have music, you want to send it to us, any way you can reach us, send us music. We'd love to play it on there.
So they're called Bad Seed?
No, they're called Mutt.
Mutt, and the song's Bad Seed. Mutt. Got it. Cool. All right, well, you're about to hear Mutt with Bad Seed. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week. Till next time, peace.
Underneath my sadness brings a whole lot of happy things, but these thoughts that are in my head are bad enough to keep them. Whole other tide of happy things, but these thoughts that are